In our last episode, we looked at what actions advanced therapies companies can take to prevent scaling issues from derailing commercialization. Part of this story is tailoring your approach to deployment. With a plethora of manufacturing environments and regulatory frameworks to choose from, navigating the evolving operating landscape is key to successfully broadening patient access. In this episode, I'll be joined by two guests who will guide us through this ecosystem as it exists in the United Kingdom. First, I'll be joined by Jacqueline Barry, Chief Clinical Officer at Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult, to talk about how regulation and access frameworks are developed and the emerging role of decentralized manufacturing in making therapies more flexible and patient-focused. Then I'll be joined by Sarah Albin, Director of the Cambridge Cellular Therapy Laboratory, to discuss how Cambridge and the wider area could benefit from enhanced manufacturing capability. She'll explain the importance of collaboration across NHS, academia, and industry, and how new regulatory frameworks could bring therapies closer to patients. And remember, if you enjoy this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and a review. Your continued support helps ensure these important topics reach a wide audience. So it's really good to see you on the podcast, and thanks for coming on. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do in the cell and gene therapy industry?
Thanks for having me on. I'm Jacqueline Barry. I'm the Chief Clinical Officer at the Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult here in the UK. And my role within Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult is very much looking at regulatory barriers, access barriers, working with the NHS, working with industry to make these products available to patients. So we cover everything from preclinical all the way through regulatory, health economics, market access, and then adoption by the NHS. But of course, within the Catapult, the wider Catapult, we help people with process development, analytical development. We have two manufacturing centres at Stevenage and at Braintree where people can come and use the facilities to manufacture. So I suppose the Catapult as a whole really tries to cover the whole value chain for advanced therapies.
And how does your previous experience and your previous work help inform what you do now?
Well, before Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult, I worked at the Scottish National Blood Transfusion Service for a number of years. And there we produce blood for the whole of Scotland, tissues and cells, also advanced therapies. So I think I was really quite lucky because I also had a quality role and I was their qualified person and responsible person for blood. So you really got to understand the regulatory and commercial requirements for advanced therapies from very, I'm talking 2005, before the ATMP regs were in force. So I suppose I've got that knowledge from before the regs were in force and the whole starting material, whether that be blood or tissues and cells.
That must be really helpful with what you're doing now.
It is, it really is. It was a good grounding for sure.
And so perhaps you can give us a little bit of an idea about what it was like then before the ATMP regs, or even go further back, and why do we need regulations in the first place?
Well, that's quite a question. I suppose I'd worked in regulatory affairs with medicinal products, so understood the medicinal products, but then I moved into blood. And actually, the blood directive only came into force in 2005, and tissues and cells in 2007, and then advanced therapies in 2009. So what we did see was an upskilling of the industry, if I can call it the blood service an upskilling, because of course the national blood services always worked to GMP, the MHRA expected GMP, but you know, the smaller blood banks, they didn't have to do GMP before 2005 for blood. So I suppose it was quite interesting seeing people understanding the requirements and gaining the new knowledge. Tissues and cells likewise had never been regulated, and then transitioning into ATMPs. So it was an interesting time, but I suppose it really made one understand the basis of the regulations. You really understood why they came into place and actually how they came into place, because sometimes it's understanding what the regulators are looking for behind the legislation that helps you understand what you require to build it in your QMS. So it was an interesting time for sure.
One of the things I wanted to understand was how regulations are developed, especially in the UK, and what impact this can have on innovation. It's particularly interesting, for example, that the MHRA has decided to implement a decentralized manufacturing regulation. And I wanted to know what Jacqueline made of this.
Do the MHRA and the NHS and biotechs and Catapult, do you all talk together, and how do you kind of find that common ground?
The Catapult's in a really privileged position because we don't manufacture anything ourselves. All we do is support the industry. So we're seen almost like, I don't know what else to call it, like an honest broker. So we can go to the MHRA and we can say these are the concerns of the industry as a whole. And likewise, the MHRA can feed back and say, well, it's really not a concern, or yeah, we need to take that away and have a think about it. But also I think, especially now that we've left the EU and we have the MHRA as the term sovereign regulator, a standalone regulator, working with the MHRA, which we do, to look how can the UK stay aligned to Europe, probably stay in aligned, well, we are Europe, but stay aligned to the EU.
Right.
But how can we use, how can we streamline things? And we do work with the MHRA, bringing together the NHS industry, ourselves, and the MHRA to look at these and think about possibilities.
So you're almost talking about creating new regulation here that enables some sort of innovative approach. What are the kind of inputs that are being gathered? How do you actually consult on a new piece of regulation? How does that process work?
Well, I suppose the MHRA have their own consultation process, don't they? So once it gets to a state where it's ready to be put out for consultation, then they will follow the consultation process, which we always feed into. But I suppose before that, we quite often would work with industry, workshop, get some ideas, work with the MHRA. Right. We quite often have workshops with the MHRA, bring together the NHS with them, and then look at what's in the art of the possible. There's no point in the MHRA coming up with a scheme that's going to accelerate tremendously if actually there's a requirement through ethics that you need something slightly different. So you really have to be looking at the whole development pathway, don't you, and planning early on. And I think that's where cell and gene therapy Catapult are really privileged, that we can have those stakeholder engagement discussions with or without the MHRA. Sometimes it's not appropriate for the MHRA to join.
Yeah, it's kind of quite a nice forum to convene.
Exactly.
All the right.
Exactly. One example was myself and Jan Rees at the MHRA have worked, I think, for over a decade talking about decentralized manufacturing, which the legislation's out. And Jan and I used to hit it about and see what's in there possible. And it's actually quite a lot of it's built on plasma products and blood products and how you approve them. So, you know, that was a long time in gestation, just talking about, well, what would be useful? Would people use it? When should people use it? And that, I think that's really valuable, because you get, Jan wasn't only speaking to me, he was speaking to people throughout the industry, large pharma, standard pharmaceutics, and then really using all of our inputs for him to fine tune it, which then went through the legislation.
So if we just take it back a couple of steps, why was it that you'd landed on decentralized as a theme, as something that you thought was going to be particularly enabling? Why is it so important to have decentralized manufacturing?
You know, I think back then, a lot of it was to do with a lot of the ATMPs that were being developed had really short shelf lives. There wasn't much cryopreservation going on. So we are talking 12 years ago. It was a long time ago. So I think it very much was the short-term problem of I was releasing a product that has a six-hour shelf life. So if you've got a six-hour shelf life and you've got to QP release it and then you've got to transport it, if it's anything across the corridor and you're going between cities, it becomes problematic. So that was the basis of it. But then he saw examples of other really short shelf life products. So that was the basis of it. But then I think very much they're looking at it holistically now. It's not just about shelf life. It might be that if you've got a really short manufacturing process, let's say you've got a manufacturing process of 2 days, there's nonsensical in spending 2 weeks shipping it out to the US and back. Or what?
To come back again, yeah.
Exactly. And I think what they've talked about, and I think it's really important, is it's a modular manufacturer. So it's not everything's at the patient's bedside. It might be that you've got a hub and spoke model. If it's not appropriate, if it's much more appropriate to use a traditional centralized manufacturing process, that's what the MHRA will expect. So I think they're really trying to look at what's best suited for those product types and be as flexible as possible.
that flexibility is important. I mean, just what interested to hear what you think about kind of how does the mix of manufacturing capacity, manufacturing capability look like in the UK, and how might it evolve in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I suppose just now we're very traditional and it's more centralised, isn't it? But I know that certainly some of the developers here in the UK, we've got developers like Oribio, and you've got people like Multanian from Germany, whose model would allow a modular manufacturing or a decentralised manufacturing. You've also got a lot of academic units who are used to manufacturing their own product. So I suppose it depends on the product and the type of product, the patient group, about whether I could answer what's our capability like just now, because I think there's a smattering of capabilities for all of those things.
Just thinking about implementing an implementation of this now, where do you see changes being needed from a sort of operational point of view that might help organizations deploy this a bit more easier?
To a modular manufacturing process.
Yeah.
I suppose, like I mentioned earlier, you've got to make sure that you understand all of your sites and how they're operating, and you need to have an oversight of that. Your QP needs to be really comfortable. If they're doing remote QP release, how do they satisfy themselves that all of the sites are operating as they should be? You can defer that down to a quality manager, and you have to be confident of that quality manager. I suppose understanding the stresses and strains will be different on the site at local levels than they would be at a centralised. There might only be three people on site, so if people are going off on holiday,
and they might be trying to do other things as well.
Exactly. So I think just understanding the different constraints, whilst it might be more agile, the resource constraints and the facility constraints might impact that agility. So I think just understanding all of that and making sure your QMS is fit for purpose. And I suppose, as with everything, if you're moving to a decentralized manufacturing process, speaking with the regulators, speaking with people who are ex-auditors, and really getting a picture of where your weak spots are, if you have any, and then making sure that you focus on them. Because once you've got multi-sites, things falling through the cracks could potentially be much easier, couldn't it? So you have to ensure that those sites are communicating really well.
I really enjoyed my conversation with Jacqueline, and her broad insight and experience helps us really understand how the space is evolving. Here are my key takeaways from our conversation. Bringing cell and gene therapies to patients is a multi-stakeholder endeavor. Developers, clinicians, and regulators all have a valuable perspective on the best way to deliver to patients. Regulations can and do evolve to better serve the needs of industry and patients. The MHRA has provided additional flexibility in deployment through the decentralized manufacturing regulation. Finally, bringing more organizations under the manufacturing framework could reduce cost and time while providing flexibility to adapt to different products and patient needs, so long as the same levels of quality and consistency are met. Next, I speak with Sarah Alban, Director of the Cambridge Cellular Therapy Laboratory. We talk about how Cambridge is preparing to move from processing and receiving therapies made elsewhere to manufacturing them locally. Sarah also shares her perspective on working with regulators and industry, and what the new decentralized manufacturing framework would mean to her in practice. Well, welcome onto the podcast. It's really nice to see you. I wonder if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about what you do at Addenbrooke's in the cellular therapy laboratory.
Yes, of course. And thank you so much for inviting me to join this podcast with you today. It's a great opportunity. So I'm Sarah Alban, and I'm currently the director of the Cambridge Cellular Therapy Laboratories at Addenbrooke's Hospital. So because that's a mouthful, I think I'll just use the acronym CCTL. So I've been here in Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge for coming up for 6 years now. But in terms of where I came from, I sort of started my postgrad work at the Royal Free Hospital as a trainee clinical scientist in immunology. So while I was there, I got a master's degree in medical immunology, and that helped me achieve my registration in as a clinical scientist. So I'm registered with the HCPC. I'm a chartered scientist as well. And then during the time when the NHS was undergoing its agenda for change and restructuring, I sidestepped into cell therapy R&D, if you like, at Great Ormond Street and UCL. And I spent 10 years there. And that was probably the bulk of my career so far. That was in scaling up usually PhD projects to make therapy products under GMP conditions. So I ran a team there, and we had several successful trials where we actually managed to complete the bench to bedside for a number of different conditions.
Interested to hear what sort of phase those therapies were at. When you say it was kind of R&D and scale, what was therapy at that stage?
So we were looking at first in man.
Right, okay.
Yeah, we were looking at first in man, and it was a variety of different settings. But yeah, several of them were first in man clinical trial products.
That's very exciting, but also high pressure.
Very high pressure, and it was a phenomenally steep learning curve, which I think has, because of my background already in the NHS and immunology, has given me quite a unique sort of skill set to put all these things together. And I think that is largely how I was successful in obtaining the post here at Cambridge, because it's a senior leader position that I've got, but the strategic vision for cell therapy here in Cambridge is something that is exceptionally close to my heart. And at the moment, we don't manufacture here like I was in London. And really, it's sort of the forefront of the strategic vision to make that a reality in Cambridge, so we can serve the sort of the regional East of England network.
Where does your kind of influence stop at the moment on that journey towards manufacturing?
It doesn't really. I'm the director of cell therapy, so I've got quite a strong influence. And fortunately, there's a lot of key stakeholders here in Cambridge with a very significant interest in cell therapy manufacture. I mean that both NHS and academic, and even some industry partners that are looking to collaborate. So there are lots of different people that are working together to make manufacturing of cell therapies a reality in Cambridge in the very, very near future.
What are some of the things that you're hoping to do differently that you can't do right now in Cambridge?
Okay, so at the moment, we're a regional processing laboratory, and we're HTA licensed and JC accredited. And the bread and butter of that service is bone marrow transplantation or stem cell transplantation for the East of England. And over the recent years, the commissioned CAR cell service. We also work with a lot of advanced therapy investigational medicinal products in forms of cell therapies for lots of different conditions, but we buy them in or we receive them in from abroad or other areas in the UK. So to enable us to manufacture our own personalized medicines, we need to increase our regulatory compliance with the MHRA, who regulate all of the productions for medicines and health, and obtain the necessary licenses that we need. So we are looking to license the facility that we've got at the moment on the Cambridge campus, but also we are imminently moving into a brand new facility in the JCBC building on the Cambridge Biomedical campus. And that's got clean rooms in it that will enable us to handle the genetically modified organisms, of which you need to for manufacturing things like CAR-Ts. So the first manufacturers we'll do are likely to be non-GMO, so very simple manufacturers involving bone marrow manipulation or therapeutic cells, mesenchymal stem cells, things like that.
With a minimum of genetic modification.
Zero genetically modification in the first instance to sort of embed manufacturing here in a slow and steady and controlled way.
Trying to make kind of incremental changes to what you're currently doing so that the big leap.
Very much so, because it's not just incremental changes with the sort of technology, it's incremental training with the workforce and hugely with the quality management system as well, that we need to be able to control these products as well. So start simple, sort of end strong, but sort of the front runners for the GMOs in the first instance will be novel CAR-Ts, probably for myeloma and additionally a solid organ cancer as well. So there's lots and lots of really exciting projects in the pipeline. And I think it's really exciting to say that it's not just it's not just liquid cancers and it's not just hemato-oncology cancers we're looking at. It's solid cancers, but also it's not oncology as well. So there's interest in cardiac regeneration and neurological conditions as well. So it's really broad. The impact or the potential of cell therapy here in Cambridge with the clinical sort of expertise we have, but also the research expertise we have with our collaborators, is absolutely huge.
Super interesting thinking about exactly what you just said, all of the different indications that we could treat using cell therapies. And how does that collaboration between research and manufacturing, or what will become manufacturing, how does that work? How do you kind of leverage all of that great talent in Cambridge?
Communication and passion and finding like-minded individuals with the same drive that you do. So my expertise lies in the getting the product to clinic, the scale up, the compliance with regulation, the liaison with the regulatory bodies, and then actually delivering those products within a clinical trial with the support of a clinical trials network and sponsor. On here on campus, we've got so many academic institutions, and there are so many just within the University of Cambridge. And once you start reaching out and finding those people who are really driven to develop these cell therapies for unmet needs, because they've either been personally impacted or they have their own patient cohort with an unmet need, mm-hmm. It's very easy to connect and go, right, how do we now facilitate the translation? And that's the key in Cambridge at the moment. That's what we're missing. We're missing that little last piece of the puzzle, which is the translation step and being able to manufacture these R&D products in a way that's GMP compliant, so it's suitable to go into a human. And while our manufacturing license is being applied for and the rooms are getting ready, the translational steps have already started, in that the academics are coming to me and saying, how can we speed this up, Sarah? How can we get this into the clinic? And I'm able to say, well, you know, that there are huge differences in R&D compared to the sort of the clinical manufacture. And it can be as simple as, you cannot use this media because it contains an animal component, or you can't use this because it's not closed. And so I'm already, and I've over the past 5 years have been giving advice about processes, training, compliance, automation, and hugely quality control as well. Because what I don't want to happen is that we open this facility and then it mothballs because nothing's ready. So the translation step is already happening in the background. And then hopefully once...
That's an invaluable service you're providing to those to your collaborator. Sarah is clearly heavily invested in the patient-centric side of cell therapy manufacture and has an important role to play in managing the multitude of actors inputting into the process. I wondered how she felt the decentralized manufacturing regulations would impact the wider Cambridge region and what this could mean for patients in the UK and beyond. It's interesting, though, that I think a lot of the regulations probably were developed with more of maybe a small molecule mentality, or maybe even biologics, where one batch can serve a lot, a high number of patients. But that's not really the case with the personalized therapies. Have you seen any sort of shift there that kind of acknowledges the differences between cell therapies and a more traditional pharmaceuticals?
I think there was a big shift. I think it was around 2001 when cell therapies, or certain cell therapies, well, there was a distinction made between cell therapy and a cellular medicine. Mm-hmm. And I think that was when it all sort of kicked off, that actually, you know, these are novel products. They're not just therapeutic, they're novel products, they are drugs, they need to be managed and controlled separately. Despite that, cell therapies at the moment are being made in a very centralized fashion, often in quite a factory-based setting, and especially regard to those three CAR T cell therapies. But I think that have been licensed and they have their manufacturing authorization, so they're very centrally controlled, and that is mainly to preserve that quality control, the safety, the regulatory oversight, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, they're made under one, almost under one roof, as it were.
Quite literally, actually, yeah. Quite literally. And that is obviously done to control the product as best they can as a drug, as a medicinal product, but it does have its downsides. And it's only sort of very recently, I'd say probably since the pandemic, that we've seen a shift in sort of the regulatory authorities responding to the sort of explosive evolution of the cell therapy landscape, like globally, that actually, if the extrapolation of the amount of patients we want to treat carries on going as we expect it to, we will certainly not as the NHS be able to meet those clinical demands in terms of numbers of patients for any given indication, but also the diversity of the indications that cell therapies are being developed for.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why things like decentralized manufacture, as in point of care or hub and spoke models, have been mooted and reviewed for suitability, if you like, over the past 5 years or so. But that's still being done with cell therapies being lumped in with small molecules, sort of pharmaceuticals,
right,
and biologics and vaccines and things like that. So I think cell therapies are given, but it's very unique, particularly in terms of its unpredictability and its personalized nature. And it kind of makes sense that would be right at the patient bedside. But is how do you sort of mitigate the sort of the risks regarding the control and the equipment and the workforce, et cetera, that's needed to manage that? But that said, the most recent framework that's been released by the MHRA is really promising because it's detailed enough that it outlines different opportunities for increasing the scale of cell therapy manufacturers in the UK. It's also got a lot of guidelines and supportive information with it, which is really promising because if it works, it will work.
Yeah.
But taking into account that the uniqueness of cell therapies, I think it's still going to be quite case-by-case basis in terms of the type of manufacturer and the type of patient and the type of product that you've got.
Yeah, and so just maybe do that little fast forward and think about, well, so imagine there is a rollout across the UK. What does this kind of shift in regulatory framework mean that we can do now that wouldn't have been possible before or would have been very hard to do previously?
It means that certain therapies or certain cell products, if they meet certain criteria, could be manufactured far closer to the patient. So either in a local district general hospital or in a district general hospital, for example, or it could be made literally at the patient bedside in theatres or on a ward if the right equipment and the right sort of environment was there. But also the whole framework can be extended out to the potential to manufacture at a patient's home, which sounds crazy. And I'm yet to engage that part of my brain, which thinks actually, would that ever work for a cell therapy? It might work for a protein, but I'm not sure. It might do one day if sort of the infrastructure is there. But that's the aim. It's that flexibility of getting, sort of addressing the backlogs of waiting lists for central manufacture sites and bringing the manufacturer much closer to the patient so it can be delivered in a far more timely fashion. That is
it's sort of accommodating a little bit of that supply chain because you're cutting out a lot of the logistics travel step, aren't you?
So, I mean, we deliver personalized cell therapies every single day. The difference with the concept of decentralized manufacture is that you are making the timelines shorter. Equity as well. So the idea of potentially Cambridge being a hub or a center site and then other smaller sites within the East of England being spokes, you are
falling under your remit. Yeah.
So you're facilitating a treatment for those patients who potentially, and actually I do know of a case. I know a case of a patient where they could not facilitate travel. This was to London actually, for active treatment. And that affected their treatment pathway. If we were offering it in Cambridge, it might have changed the situation. But if we could offer it in, I don't know, Norfolk or Norwich, Ipswich, yeah, King's Lynn, it's that accessibility. So that is what the framework is being designed to do, to provide manufacturers with, in the UK, with a legal framework to work in order to respond to the demand for cell therapies and then increase that patient accessibility.
We heard from both Sarah and Jacqueline about how patient-centric thinking was driving an evolution in the regulatory framework. I was interested to hear their take on what more needed to be done to roll out manufacturing capability more widely and whether greater levels of automation could be beneficial. First, Sarah. I know you've spoken about a vision, and yeah, sure, this is just the East of England where you have the central hub and many spoke sites, but of course, this is generalizable for anywhere. What do you think are the main things in the way of us getting to that sort of vision at the moment?
We've been given guidance by the regulators about how to do it, but how that works in practice is yet to be seen. Say, with the MHRA does sort of give you guidance on developing manufacturing site files for your own site, but then also your sort of spoke sites.
Yeah, I suppose
well.
you're delegating to people who haven't necessarily got any experience of manufacturing whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't do that without, I think, certain, how do you say, sort of infrastructure being in place, but also your quality control over the system. So I would be happier, say, delegating a small little robotic closed plug and play end-to-end device to a patient bedside than I would be sending an isolator and a big old bioreactor, because I know that I'm going to need people who can operate those, who can check on them, who can, do you see what I mean? So I think it's this sort of the tech sort of transfer almost market going, right, what do we need to do to actually make this a reality?
It feels like there might be an opportunity to adapt some of the ways that the therapies are manufactured.
I think that's an absolute given. I think if you were to decentralize, you would need a manufacturing process that is almost completely locked down.
Mm-hmm.
So
not much for any kind of judgment calls.
No. So you would want as much automation as possible. So really you'd be looking at a plug and play model with a minimum amount of human interpretation. So mm-hmm. I think not only does there need to be a big shift towards automation, I think there needs to be a big shift towards sort of AI and robotics and interpretation. And although possible, again, slightly challenging with cell therapies because of the variability in the nature.
And finally, Jacqueline's thoughts. I think about just 5 years in the future. If you had a magic wand and you were going to say, I'm going to point this at one area of advanced therapies ecosystem, where would you like to see changes that would have the most impact on the greatest number of patients?
I think there's many answers to that. I think in the manufacturing forum, I think automation, which we've just been mentioning, and digitalization, because they can do a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
They can drive down costs, because you can do the same operation many times. They should drive up consistency, mm-hmm. which is always a good thing, and hopefully quality, so maybe less batch failures. So I think automation is super important. And actually here at Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult, I'm actually sat in our Stevenage site just now we're investing quite a lot in that.
You opened your test beds, right, a couple of months
ago? Yeah, exactly. So I think that's something that we need to be looking towards to drive down cost of goods. I think in the regulatory space, I think us all really understanding where the risk benefit lies for these products, we're still quite naive in terms of how the products work. Over the last 10 years, we actually understand the products a lot more. So once you understand the science better, you understand where the potential risks are, don't you? And therefore, you can accommodate them. So I think keep on increasing our scientific knowledge, and what will flow from that would be a regulated confidence, I suppose. But as we gather data on these types of products, what will we start to see? Will we be able to gain more confidence? Will we be able to see a persistence that could be translated into another similar product? But also, there's an understanding that these products are potentially life-saving. They certainly can improve people's quality of life if they're efficacious.
Yeah.
Which might allow people to get back to work, or it might allow a carer or a parent to be able to go back to work because their child, if it's a parent, is actually potentially cured. So they can just lead a normal life, which means a parent can lead a normal life and go back and work in a high-value job,
mm-hmm.
which will bring tax benefits, will bring revenue to the country. So I suppose an understanding of that whole benefit, not just the benefit to the patient, but the benefit to society, the societal benefit, I think that's really important as well.
It was fantastic to hear the ambition and drive of both Jacqueline and Sarah to get these advanced therapies into the hands of more patients. With reflecting on this clinical perspective, as well as the manufacturing strategies which we spoke about in the previous episode, my key takeaways are: be open to innovation. Who thought that the key to unlocking the potential of CAR-Ts would be robotic manufacturing? What other solutions might we find in unexpected places? The cell and gene therapy industry is maturing. Regulators, therapy developers, and clinicians all need to pursue closer alignment to ensure efficient distribution. Put patients first. Our efforts should ensure more patients getting access to the therapies they need at a price and location that is convenient to them. Practically thinking, the ingredients for success lie in keeping patient needs at the center of manufacturing, as hospitals and regulators are clearly now doing, ensuring processes are adequate for the scale of deployment, and leveraging the right expertise at the right time for efficient development. That's all for now. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, remember to go back and listen to the rest of this season's episodes, wherever you get these podcasts.